You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
It's the month of love, so let's celebrate the love of the blues and the legend Willie Mae Thornton, a.k.a. Big Mama Thornton. Tune in Friday, February 13th at 8 p.m. with me, Katie Zipp, to rejoice in the power of Thornton's storied career, only on Double Groove, only on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, FBI agencies balance and records from the 2020 election. Voter fraud fighter Greg Palast tells us why, and it's not what you might think. Also, we feature our weekly broadcast of the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barros-Friedman, and Kathy Kelly will join us for a crucial remembrance. All this and more coming up straight ahead. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine over the People's Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. Happy to have you along. And we are happy to welcome back our old friend Greg Palast. You remember the Election Crimes Bulletin? Well, Greg's got another piece out today. We wanted to get right to him because, as usual, he is right on the mark where the corporate media is somewhere out in left field. Let me read you a little bit about what Greg writes today. For God's sake, let's get to the real agenda behind Wednesday's FBI raid on the Fulton County Elections Office. It's not about the 2020 election. The warrant says the FBI wants the envelopes from the 2020 election to hunt for crimes. But that's just the legal excuse for stormtrooping. Greg says this is all about 2026 and 2028. Greg Palast, welcome back to Flashpoints. Let's maybe give us a first response to this, the big news story, and then let's get into the crucial aspects of the story, which have everything to do with Fulton County, Black Atlanta, and ultimately we're going to get to drop boxes. So lay this out for us.
All right. So we had an FBI raid on Fulton County Elections Office. Fulton County, which you probably know, is the center of the city of Atlanta, Black Atlanta. It was, while it's Trump's claim, you know, that he won the 2020 election and the theft was at the center of the so-called theft was Fulton County, that black voters were stuffing ballot boxes. So, but it's not about Trump trying to prove that he really won the 2020 election. That's how the national media played it. But I will say that the local elections activists that I've been speaking to, you know, whether it's Reverend Jesse Jackson, Gerald Griggs of the Georgia NAACP and Black Voters Matter Fund, this is not about 2020. This is about basically stealing, bending the 2026 election and the 2028 election. Right now, understand what's at stake here. John Ossoff is running for re-election. Progressive Democrat who, they are gunning for. They can't, he has like a 70% approval rating. It's amazing. They can't win by convincing people to vote against Ossoff because it's just not there in the polls. What they can do is stop people from voting. And which people? People of color and students, and also the kind of progressives and LGBTQ community of Atlanta. How are they doing this? What does this have to do with seizing these ballots, Dennis? Well, it goes back to a film we've discussed called 2000 Mules, created by a group called True the Vote. The film was launched at Mar-a-Lago, and it claims that Mark Zuckerberg And George Soros paid black men, and they emphasize that it's all black men, $10 for every illegal ballot they stuff into a drop box in Atlanta. Now, understand that the which is an interesting combination of anti-Semitism and racism, you know. And the reason I'm laughing is what person would take $10 to commit a felony crime on camera, because every single drop box has a camera on it that identifies the voter. Furthermore, every ballot, people, if you look at your California mail-in ballot, you'll see a barcode on the outside. That is specific to you. When Dennis, you get your ballot, it's a Dennis Bernstein barcode. If someone else votes it and there's a picture of someone else dropping it off, that ballot, that person's committed a felony crime, they will get arrested. It's very easy to catch someone who tries to pull that stunt. So the Republicans, Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, and Brian Kemp, they kind of forced Fulton County. They reviewed every single ballot in a drop box, something like $70,000. They reviewed those 70,000 ballots one by one, identified the barcodes, identified the signatures on the envelope, matched them to the registration signatures. There wasn't one single unaccounted for ballot, not one single bit of evidence that anyone cast an extra ballot, because you can't. You have to put on a special barcode. And besides, why would someone take $10 to commit this crime on a camera when you could just put a 50-cent stamp on the darn thing and stick it in the mailbox when no one's looking? But, you know, that's getting, you know, it's hard to argue with crazy. But the problem is, this ain't crazy, because what they have done is now we get to the come down on this. All right, it's phony that they're illegal alien voters, that they're 2,000 mules. That's what they call the black men, that there are 2,000 black men, the mules, carrying out this crime. Because what they want to do, and they've already done a damn good job of it, is eliminate early voting, drop box voting, mail-in voting.
Let me jump in here, Greg, and let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are delighted to be welcoming Greg Palast back. We're talking about Trump's seizure of ballots and information in Atlanta, sort of a throwdown. Now, I want you to talk more about this, Greg. It's crucial. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't you say the corporate press, after all now, Trump's been elected twice, that the corporate press has underestimated and mischaracterized Trump in this context? Like, Trump's a bungling idiot and he's not here?
Yeah, no, he's not. He's crazy like a fox. I mean, and I will say that Mark Elias, who is a nominally a lawyer for the Democratic Party, also said this was about 26 and 28. But no Democratic leaders, and certainly none of the mainstream media. It's all about, oh, crazy Trump, he just wants to prove he won 2020. That's not what's at stake. Here's a fact we need to know to get somewhere. 70% of African Americans vote early, either using a ballot drop box, a mail-in ballot, or in-person early voting. And without the drop boxes, Trump would have won Georgia. And the only reason he won in 2024 is that under SB 202, which was passed after Biden took Georgia, and if you remember also in that same election, you had Ossoff and Democratic Senator Reverend Warnock won election. So you had a Democratic wipeout, and they wiped out the GOP in Georgia. It could not have been done without a massive use of drop boxes in Atlanta. But in 24, they cut the number the state cut the number of drop boxes in Atlanta and Savannah, the two big black cities. They cut them by 75%, saying that you had to, by 75%, it was one drop box for each 100,000 voters. Can you imagine? So that slashed the number of early voters in the black community. Yes. Plus, they put away the drop box at 5 o'clock when inside buildings. And the whole point of drop box is that you can go 24/7. You're a doctor working at a hospital. And so what happened was between, for example, the 2020 election and the 2022 election, after the new law came in, they cut the days of early voting. They cut your access to the ballot drop boxes in particular. They cut mail-in voting access a number of days. The result was that, and the mainstream press totally missed this, the number of votes dropped from 1.1 million votes in, or yeah, 1.2 million votes, which were mailed in and put in drop boxes, to 0.2 million. In other words, they lost 83% of the mail-in vote, and that was crucial to Trump winning in 2024 because they made it so difficult. And the thing is, Dennis, whatever is test-driven in Georgia, we've talked about this many times, which is why I keep going to Georgia. Whatever the test drive in Georgia goes nationwide, after SB 202 passed, 30 states passed laws restricting drop boxes and mail-in balloting. And they did that with the excuse that they were trying to stop this so-called voter fraud, even though, again, they didn't find one fraudulent ballot. In fact, in this film, 2000 Mules, which Trump has been promoting, you see Charlie Kirk. Remember that guy? Charlie Kirk. I'm not going to say anything other than he was in that film with some other right-wing jokers watching what they watched a black man putting ballots in a mailbox. You'll see this in my film, Vigilantes, Inc., by the way. And putting ballots in a drop box. One drops on the ground, he sticks it in, and then he hustles back to his car. And these people are saying, you're looking at OJ running from the scene of a crime. It's because he's a black man putting ballots in a box. It turns out the guy that they kept showing again and again, it's a guy named Mark Andrews. He's a Verizon executive in Atlanta. And he was legally dropping off his and his family's ballots, his daughter's and his wife's ballots, which is legal under Georgia law. But it was a black man sticking ballots in a drop box. So obviously he's committing a crime. And that's the game that's being played here. And it's dangerous. And they're trying to grab these ballots so they can look at, so the feds can look once again at the barcodes, at the signatures, et cetera, and say, aha, these are illegal ballots. But, you know, again, I don't trust them because they've physically carted off these things. But they've been reviewed by Fulton and by the GOP executives of that state, who would have loved, Brian Kemp, the governor, would have loved to hand the state to Trump. But he wasn't going to wear an orange suit. Remember, let's not forget that Trump, with this game, was charged with felonious racketeering. You know, Fani Willis, the Fulton County prosecutor, screwed it up because of her personal stuff. But, you know, Brian Kemp really didn't want to wear an orange suit for Donald Trump.
Now, we have to say, Greg, that this what we're talking about now, this issue, what's happening in Atlanta, again, we can't overstate the fact that this has everything to do whether the Trump neo-fascists are going to control the future, or there is going to be something close to an election that allows for a fair, you know, electoral process for a candidate. This is the heart of the matter, right? And the corporate Republican Democrats aren't all that interested in this story.
Well, remember, if everyone gets to vote, Dennis, you're going to have a very, very different set of candidates who are going to be elected in primaries. The incumbents ain't going to do too well if everyone got the vote. If you didn't have bias in voting against the poor, people of color, students, you'd have a very different electorate, and therefore a very different elected official. So the current Democratic Party is not exactly favorable to this action. In fact, I can't tell you in my career how much trouble and strife I've gotten from the Democratic Party. They've tried to shut me down many times. They say, don't talk about vote suppression. I know it sounds crazy because it's their voters in the main that are being suppressed. But Trump is using Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, as his model. And he doesn't have to call off elections. People are worried about calling off the 26 or 28 elections. All you have to do is make it so bent that you do it like Hungary, where you have such control over the voting in the courts that it, you know, it's just a pretend election. They're not going to call it off. People go in the streets for that. But Americans, as long as they're given, you know, allowed to pretend, it's like having, you know, when you're a kid and you've got that little kiddie seat with the wheel and you can pretend you're driving. Well, you can pretend you're voting. But they can't steal all the votes all the time. So I tell everyone, don't steal your own vote by not voting. Fight for that vote.
Right.
But there's a couple of other things that they are doing with this. You know, it's a triple threat. This grabbing of the Fulton files. Number one, they're bringing back our old friend. For those of you who saw my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, they're bringing back interstate cross-check. This is from an executive order by Donald Trump. So if they get these records, they want the registration records, they want to prove that Jose Garcia, who lives in Atlanta, voted, and a Jose Garcia who lives in Texas voted, obviously that's the same guy voting twice. And you say, well, Jose Garcia, I mean, that's just a common Hispanic name. They say, well, it's not necessarily common for Republicans. So they're coming, bringing this back. We thought we had defeated this, Dennis, by working lawsuits brought by the ACLU, Black Voters Matter, NAACP. I was an expert witness in those cases, and it was done. We thought we'd whacked this one on the head. It's back. Now, and there's a third one, Dennis, you'll love this, and this connects with ICE. There is something, I don't want to get the name wrong offhand, but I believe it's called the START program, database, which is the database of all the people that Homeland Security has deported. Discovered to be illegally, they get deported. Once again, we go back to Jose Garcia, who gets deported back to Salvador. And then they find a Jose Garcia voting in Miami. Oh, well, obviously, Jose Garcia swam back from Salvador to across the Caribbean to Miami to vote. And the last time they did this, Dennis, you know, look, if you're not an American citizen, don't vote. It's a crime. They don't. Because last time they tried to use the deportation list database against the voting roll was in Florida. During the Obama administration, court ordered Obama to turn over these deportation records. They removed 179,000 people from the voter rolls of Florida, almost all of them Hispanic. They removed those people, and now they were allowed to get back on the rolls. All they had to do was take a day off work, go to a federal court, and prove to a judge that they are who they are and that they're an American citizen. It is a felony crime. How many people went to jail of the 179,000 voters? How many were actually convicted of the crime of voting while a non-citizen? The answer, Dennis, I won't make you guess, is one. One, an Austrian Republican who went to prison, by the way, for 10 years.
You said an Austrian Republican, huh?
179,000.
Yeah.
Hmm? Yeah.
An Austrian Republican. Yeah.
Well, so what's happened is that, again, using racial profiling, and now the Supreme Court has authorized this. You can, you know, go ahead and look through the voter rolls for everyone named Hernandez, everyone named Levy, and wipe them out, because you can now, the Supreme Court has authorized racial and ethnic profiling. And it doesn't just stop at looking at someone in a car. Your profile is in your name. This is what's coming to us. It's not about 2020, my friends. It is about 26 and 28. And by the way, I will be having a virtual showing of Vigilantes Inc. And you can see my whole breakdown of 2,000 Mules within that film. It's a film within a film. I do the whole breakdown, and I'll be doing that next Thursday for Indivisible Nationwide, and it will be based out of Chicago live. So if you're in Chicago, go to Greg Powell's website, and you can come into the live or watch online. That'll be 4:30 Pacific.
Beautiful. And Greg, last we spoke many months ago, we last election, we were talking about another level of intimidation, sort of physical intimidation, the making illegal bringing water to somebody who is waiting online to vote in a very difficult weather condition. Are those kinds of structures still in place, or were they to be unconstitutional?
No, they're totally. See, one of the excuses that they hide behind, even though the feds are moving in, is that it's all up, that voting in the Constitution, the procedures and processes up to each state, as long as it doesn't violate other parts of the Constitution, like the 14th Amendment, which we thought protected us. 14th Amendment, which used to be about equal protection for people of color, that's why it was there, has just become a cover for corporate so-called personhood. So we have the problem that the 14th Amendment has now been bastardized into a corporate protection plan. But the whole point of it was actually they were thinking very much about voting, that you can't take away someone's vote because of their color of their skin or that they were previously enslaved. That is a problem. So we have in Georgia, for example, in SB 202, we really have the strengthening of the law that says if you give someone a bottle of water while waiting in line, you have to understand Georgia can be, 100% humidity. And you got elderly people waiting in line. And you can't give a bottle of water. You can't give them any food. It's a felony. And they mean it. And I can tell you that I was there. And that type of thing is spreading. Again, the closing of the drop boxes in places like Texas, for example. Ken Paxton, who's now running for Senate, he is the attorney general, who was, by the way, impeached for corruption. But he's now running for Senate, and he bragged. You'll see this in Vigilantes, in my film. He bragged that that if he hadn't stopped mailing out ballots to the people of Houston, which has the largest black population of any city in America. If he didn't stop 2.5 million ballots going out to Houston voters during COVID, that Donald Trump would have lost Texas. That's Texas, Dennis. They can't hold Texas if they didn't use this trickery. It is very serious. Don't ask the Democratic Party to take care of you on this. They're getting a little slightly more savvy. Certainly people like John Ossoff, who I've known for a long time, is very, very savvy about this. So is Reverend Warnock. I've talked to him about this. Georgia, the problem is that if they get away with it in Georgia, it looks like they are. Next is Minnesota. They want those lists. It's a swing state. Michigan's a swing state. They want those lists. They want them from Illinois. You've got governors resisting, but Texas was thrilled to hand over its voter rolls to the justice, so-called Justice Department. It's really, and if you want more info on this, by the way, just go to gregpalace.com or my Substack, Greg Palace Investigates on Substack.
I have to tell you, Greg, your earlier film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, really was so cutting edge and so clear about how essentially these elections would be transformed if people really had the right to vote. But it doesn't seem like it's going in the right direction. We have 30 seconds. What's the final note for today?
Well, actually, go watch The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. It's actually quite entertaining. At gregpalace.com, you can get that link through for free and stream it. And because to be informed, it's just like you want to be aware that there's a pickpocket around and watch your pockets. And the other final thing is don't throw away your own vote. Please check your registration 60 days before the election. Make sure you haven't been purged, blocked, challenged. There's so much more for us to go over, and so I guess we're back in the Election Crimes Bulletin, like it or not.
All right. Thank you, Greg, for taking the time out for us today. We know you got a lot on the plate. Stay safe. Come back soon. You're always welcome here.
Thank you, Dennis. Bye.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back with Kathy Kelly. You don't want to miss this segment. She's, you know her through World Beyond War, a wonderful writer, really powerful voice for peace in this world. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. We are free speech, non-corporate, no holds barred, truth to power radio. And in that regard, we welcome back to these airwaves Kathy Kelly. She is on the board. She's the board president of World Beyond War. She's a wonderful writer and a very inspiring voice for peace. Kathy, welcome back to Flashpoints. You've got an important piece. Who are the criminals? Listen to Hind Rajab. Could you tell us about the piece and what you want people to understand about this extraordinary human being who, I guess it's the second anniversary since her murder. Talk to us, please.
No, thank you, Dennis. So Hind Rajab was certainly an innocent and had never committed any crime, but neither could you say that her aunt, her uncle, and her four cousins were people convicted of crimes, and yet they were all horribly assassinated. But for Hind, it was such an ordeal. And what had happened is the Tel al-Hawa neighborhood had been told by the Israeli military, you must evacuate, we're going to attack your neighborhood. So Hind's mother set off on foot with an older sibling. It was storming and rainy. She didn't want Hind to be soaking wet. So Hind went in the car with her uncle and aunt and four cousins. But of course, you can't just drive down a street in Gaza under this time of invasion and aerial attacks. And so a cousin in Germany had been trying to help the uncle figure out with the Red Crescent what route would be best, but they got maybe turned around, and next thing they knew, the car was facing tanks, and Israeli tanks fired directly into the car, and instantly the uncle and aunt and three cousins were killed. So Hind witnessed that horror, and her surviving cousin, Layan, was able to use the phone and reconnect with the Red Crescent, the relief operators who had been trying to guide the uncle. And so they said to the children, you know, try to remain calm. But then you hear Layan screaming, the tank is closer, it's closer. And then there's an explosion. And then the line goes dead. And so the Red Crescent workers called Hind, and she was terrified, but she answered. And they stayed on the line with her and tried to urge her to stay hidden, to keep calm, and they promised rescue workers are coming. But of course, in this context, it would be suicide for rescue workers to go forth, even though it wasn't a very long distance, to go forth without coordinating with the Israeli occupation forces to kind of get the green light. So the hours went by, and the little girl is utterly terrified, and she's wounded. But finally, two relief workers are in the ambulance. They're about 150 meters away from her. They can see her, and then there's another explosion, and the Israeli Defense Forces assassinated both rescue workers, and then there was a barrage of bullets fired into the car where Hind remained. The Red Crescent operators were able to put her mother, Wissam, on the phone very briefly with Hind. And that mother has said that she knows that her daughter's voice has not been silenced. Because when that little girl said, "Please come, I'm so scared," I think she's still speaking today. And, you know, there are three films now that have been made about Hind Rajab and her family, and one of them is up for an Oscar. But, you know, I think we can just sort of change the vocabulary a little bit. "Please come, I'm so sick. Please come, I'm so cold. Please come, I'm so hungry." And those would be the voices of Gazan children today, now, who are suffering and dying and being tortured to death in this terrible winter, while the Israeli forces still refuse to allow relief trucks to go through in any scale that would meet the incredible need.
Well, we're speaking with Kathy Kelly, and this horror scene that you described, this scene of mass murder and plunder, afforded and supported by U.S. Weapons and money, and they use the word intelligence. I'm not sure that's the right word, but the U.S. does help plan out these kinds of slaughters. Kathy, what can we say in thinking about this horrific slaughter? I mean, it continues.
Well, I think we have to ask, okay, who are the criminals? And, you know, we saw this play out in Iraq when the United States destroyed the sewage and sanitation systems, and then the water that was contaminated was affecting hundreds of thousands of little children. And right now, sewage and sanitation has been decimated in Gaza. And you're looking at a situation where there are 2,500 structures destroyed, hills of rubble, and underneath the rubble, unexploded ordnance, 60 million tons of rubble. It would take 3,000 container ships to clear it. It would take 7 years to clear it. So that in itself is criminal. And then President Trump appoints Prime Minister Netanyahu to be part of his board of peace. We need to form a board of peace watch, like there is Occupation Watch and Human Rights Watch, and keep an eye on these criminal, totally violent flauntings of international law. So, and you know, we have to remember, winter is still going on. People don't have sturdy shelters. The contaminated water is saturating their bedding. It's saturating their clothes. Little children have weakened immunities. 11 have died of hypothermia. So who is being regarded as a criminal? The doctors. 95 healthcare workers, 80 of them from Gaza, are still in prison. Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, the esteemed director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital, is now in his 13th month of imprisonment, held without charge. And there are women and children who are among the thousands of Palestinian prisoners, and so many are held without charge. So criminal violations of international law happen every single day under the leadership and the partnership of the United States government. And the missiles that were found very close, tank-fired missiles, very close to the ambulance where those two workers were assassinated, were manufactured, and the number is on the missiles, by a company in the United States. So who are the criminals and how do we hold ourselves to accountability? I think the boycott, divest movement must be upheld. We must still insist that every member state of the United Nations has an obligation to stop all trade with Israel, to shun Israel, keep Israel out of sporting events, entertainment events. We have to recognize that this is a group that rivals the Nazi Holocaust creators.
And we say Nazi, but we now use Nazi and neo-Nazi advisedly, because this is the, I mean, think about Gaza and the Trump administration with the current administration in Israel talking out loud about thoroughly cleansing Gaza and turning it into a merry-go-round. This is a serious conversation they're having, and they can make a lot of money.
Yes. I mean, they're talking about charging a fee for every truck that goes into Gaza for any kind of commercial purpose, and that would generate over a billion dollars right there. So people are, they're coming like pigs to the trough to see who can make money. But, you know, I would like to go back to the White Rose Collective, those very, very brave young people in Germany, in Munich, who said, "We will not be silent." And Hans and Sophie Scholl were executed. They were killed by guillotine. How many press people in Gaza have now been killed by the Israelis because they want them silenced? It's over 250. And the reasons that so many of these healthcare workers are assassinated, their whole families assassinated with them, are imprisoned, are tortured, the reason is because of a desire to silence them. They've witnessed atrocities. They know. And so we are complicit. We in the United States are complicit with a criminal group of gangsters, and they are creating more war crimes every single day in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in what's called the Yellow Line Division, that further tries to divide and conquer people who have committed no crime.
Wow. Kathy, what at this moment, we just have a few seconds here, what are you hoping that people will understand about this? Are you hoping that they'll take some kind of action? What's the word coming from?
Hear the voice of Hind Rajab. Go to the Hind Rajab Foundation and, you know, keep an eye on how they are trying to hold people accountable and find out exactly who is responsible for these various murders. Where are they, and how can they be held accountable? And I don't see this in terms of witch hunt. I think we have to hold ourselves accountable and really investigate thoroughly the boycott and divestment efforts that have been so courageously put forward by people who are looking for a new way forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathy Kelly, for all
Thank
your
you,
work
Dennis.
Over all these years. Appreciate it.
All right. Take
Be
care
safe.
Now.
Be safe now. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, we are going to present what we do every Thursday, mostly on Thursday. We provide for you the extended newscast from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Bowers-Friedman.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 846 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Heavy Israeli shelling and tank fire remain constant across Gaza. Sources with Al Jazeera reported that Israeli forces targeted areas east of Khan Yunis on Wednesday, and warplanes bombed empty homes east of the city of Deir el-Bala in areas controlled and occupied by the Israeli military. At least two explosions took place in the north of Gaza as the Israeli army carried out demolitions in Jabalia and shelled neighborhoods east of Gaza City. Journalist Mahmoud Abu Salama recorded footage of Israeli gunfire on Jabalia camp on Sunday. He captioned this video, quote, "Despite talk of ceasefire in Gaza, this is the daily life of the residents of Jabalia camp in northern Gaza." Israeli attacks killed three Palestinians and injured three others on Tuesday in Gaza City, according to the Anadolu news agency. Among those killed was a 17-year-old boy. Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian in Jabalia on Monday, and a man was wounded by Israeli fire east of Gaza City that same day, as the Israeli army continued extensive bulldozing operations in the Al-Sanafur area and around the Al-Barch cemetery. These operations included the desecration of graves under the pretext of searching for the body of the last remaining Israeli prisoner of war in the Gaza Strip, which was returned on Monday. The Israeli army announced a large-scale search operation inside the Gaza Strip for the missing soldier and began desecrating the cemetery in eastern Gaza City, exhuming graves and destroying remains. Reporter Mahmoud Ghazi recorded footage in the aftermath of the destruction of the cemetery on Tuesday. Local sources told the Wafa news agency that the area and its surroundings were subjected to heavy artillery shelling and intense gunfire from military vehicles, as well as sniper fire and quadcopter drones, resulting in fatalities and dozens of injuries. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said it had reviewed documented reports indicating that the Israeli army dug up nearly 200 graves in the cemetery. Over the past 2 years, the human rights group says, quote, "Israel has systematically destroyed cemeteries in the Gaza Strip, dug up and vandalized graves, tampered with bodies, and transferred dozens of remains." The Israeli army has destroyed 21 out of 60 cemeteries in the Gaza Strip over the past 2 years and has systematically vandalized cemeteries and exhumed graves in all areas where it conducted ground incursions, Euromed added. Quote, "These actions included bulldozing graves, extracting remains, and crushing them with military machinery, repeatedly causing the mixing, loss, and disappearance of remains, as well as damage to neighboring graves." At least two infants have died due to hypothermia this week as Israel's blockade on proper shelters and caravans remains in place. On Saturday, a three-month-old infant, Ali Abu Zor, died from extreme cold and was taken to Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, according to the health ministry in Gaza. The ministry reported on Tuesday, January 27th, that another baby, a 12-day-old newborn named Haytham Abu Qas, also died at Al-Rantisi Hospital from hypothermia, bringing the total number of child deaths from the cold this winter season to at least 11. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians this week in separate attacks. Qusay Maher Ismail Halaika, 28, was shot and killed near a checkpoint in Bethlehem. Wafa news agency said that Israeli soldiers shot him and then left him to bleed on the ground. That killing followed the execution of a 20-year-old Palestinian, Mohammed Raje Nasrallah, on Tuesday by Israeli forces during a military raid south of Al-Khalil. Nasrallah was shot in the abdomen, according to the health ministry. During the raid, another youth was shot and injured with live ammunition. Israeli forces shot and wounded a Palestinian teenager also on Tuesday in the Qalandia refugee camp and the adjacent town of Kufr Aqab, north of occupied Jerusalem. WAFA news agency said that the teenager was injured during the second consecutive day of Israeli aggressions inside the refugee camp in Kfar Aqab, including the carrying out of demolitions of dozens of buildings, facilities, and infrastructure under the pretext of security claims and lacking Israeli-issued permits. Approximately 40 separate structures have been demolished in the area since the raid began, as heavy military vehicles and bulldozers are working to impose what the Jerusalem governorate calls a buffer zone alongside Israel's wall in the West Bank. Also in East Jerusalem, Israeli police and intelligence forces raided and shut down a screening of the feature film Palestine 36 at the Yabus Cultural Center on January 22nd. The Yabus Center stated that a unit from the intelligence services stormed the venue during the screening and ordered organizers to stop the viewing without presenting a judicial warrant. They also arrested the projectionist. Palestine 36, directed by Anne-Marie Jasser and shortlisted for an Academy Award, is about the 1936 to 1939 Arab revolt against British colonial rule in Palestine and portrays the roots of the Palestinian liberation struggle. The Israelis said that the Yabus Center was screening a film, quote, promoting work by a terrorist organization. The center described the move as, quote, a direct assault on freedom of expression and cultural activity in the city, adding that it reflects escalating restrictions imposed by Israeli authorities on Palestinian cultural life in Jerusalem in violation of international laws and conventions. Meanwhile, Israeli settler violence continues to expand across the West Bank with the support and participation of Israeli army forces. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights stated this week that, quote, state-backed settler violence has become a key driver of forced displacement, chipping away at Palestinian presence in strategic locations. Such settler-driven displacement, particularly in Bedouin and herding communities, usually follows the same pattern. An illegal outpost is erected near or inside a herding community. Settlers restrict Palestinians' access to water and grazing space. Settlers repeatedly attack communities, destroy property, infrastructure, and livestock, and injure or kill residents, the UN office said. On January 27th, approximately 300 Israeli Jewish settlers attacked areas in Masafer Yatta, south of Al-Khalil, and injured Palestinians, torched homes and property, stole livestock, and blocked ambulances that arrived to evacuate the injured, the UN said. WAFA news agency reported that one of the injured, Samir Hamamda, said he was beaten by settlers when a mob descended on his house, pelting it with stones and pepper spraying inside, wounding his wife and children. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said it treated two patients in the village of Al-Fakit, including a young man with a head injury and a girl with a broken hand. Other residents in the Masafer Yatta area were also injured, including women and children, when the settlers smashed the windows of vehicles and homes. In Khirbet al-Halawa, several Palestinians were hurt by stones thrown by the settlers, who also stole 150 sheep from the area, WAFA reported. Mohammed Hureini, a resident of Masafer Yatta and the co-founder of the Youth of Samud project, filmed the attack on Tuesday. He said, quote, over the past 5 hours, settler militias carried out a brutal pogrom against my people in my village, Masafer Yatta. The violent settlers stormed homes, burned properties, destroyed vehicles, and stole livestock. Settlers did not stop there. Their violence brought numerous injuries among civilians. All of this happened in full view of the Israeli army and police, who stood by and did nothing. Not a single settler was arrested. On the contrary, Israeli settlers assaulted two Palestinian women, and the soldiers arrested them, the women. It is organized terror carried out and enabled by the military with total impunity.
Settlers set on fire in front of the houses of the Palestinians. On the other side, you can see settlers, soldiers, watching the big one that was happening here.
We are trying now to turn off the fire.
On January 25th, Israeli settlers assaulted and injured Palestinian herders in the Rajum Ali area in the South Hebron Hills and ran over a 13-year-old Palestinian boy with a tractor, fracturing his leg. Israeli security forces were present during the attack but fired tear gas and stun grenades toward the Palestinian residents, the United Nations said. On Monday, January 26th, following repeated attacks and threats by Israeli settlers, the remaining 100 residents of the Ras Ain al-Auja Bedouin community near Jericho were forced to leave the area, bringing the number of people displaced from that community this month to about 600, according to the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. The office said that, quote, settlers had damaged or blocked herders' access to grazing areas around the community and prevented them from using the nearby spring, severely undermining their livelihoods. This comes on top of livestock theft and frequent attacks resulting in injuries and property damage. Since the beginning of January, the UN Human Rights Office, OCHA, has recorded the displacement of 688 Palestinians from 8 communities due to settler attacks, which is over 40% the number of displaced people in that category for the whole of 2025. It also comes on top of the displacement of another 130 Palestinians this month due to demolitions. OCHA is carrying out assessments and working with humanitarian partners to ensure people receive the support they need, OCHA said. Other settler attacks were recorded this past week in Jerusalem, the central and northern West Bank, the Jordan Valley, and the South Hebron Hills. The attacks resulted in extensive property damage, arson attacks, injuries, and forcible displacement of Palestinian families, primarily affecting Bedouin and herding households, according to the UN. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Trapped Between Two Different Worlds by Ahmed Abu Shawish, writing from Gaza. It's 9 p.m. Gaza time, Abu Shawish writes. Rain is pounding against the broken, nylon-covered windows of my family's home in Nusayrat, central Gaza, and the wind pushes through every small crack. I'm sitting at my desk, holding a cup of coffee, and thinking about my father. We had a routine before 2023 of late-night conversation, coffee, and long walks. But tonight there will be no long walk, and our conversation is happening through a WhatsApp video call. When he calls, I can hear the rain twice, once from outside my window and once through his phone speakers, from thousands of kilometers away in Italy. The same storm falling on two different worlds. My father, Dr. Mohammed Abu Shawish, was evacuated from Gaza to Italy in September 2025, leaving behind the six of us, including my mother and my four siblings. Tonight, through a screen, we try to recreate the comfort of our walks and late-night talks. But nothing feels the same. His face is lit by the warm, stable light of an apartment in Europe, mine by the dim yellow of a battery-powered lamp. My father and I share the same quiet nature. We don't complain easily, and we don't talk about our fears much. In September 2023, he was awarded a scholarship to continue his postdoctoral studies at the University of Milano Bicocca, with a departure date of October that year. He postponed his studies several times, despite the multiple calls from the Italian embassy urging him to evacuate. He chose to remain with us through those early months of devastation and displacement. He believed that the genocide would soon come to an end and that we would all be able to go to Italy. However, that hope slowly faded over time. After more than 700 days, we reached the painful conviction that the suffering might last indefinitely. My father called the embassy in September 2025, hoping that it might evacuate all of us. But later that month, on a Friday morning, an official at the embassy called back with a message, "You'll be evacuated on Monday." Before he could even ask about his family, the official added, "But unfortunately, alone." My father asked on the video call if I had started studying Italian. It wasn't the first time he had mentioned it. Ever since he reached Milan, he has encouraged me to learn the language, repeating, "You have to prepare yourself to come here." But I have not started to learn Italian. I can't quite believe I will ever go there. I nod and say, Inshallah. This time, though, I laughed and told him that I barely have time for that. My days are consumed by my engineering courses at the Islamic University of Gaza, interrupted constantly by errands and lines to buy food and retrieve water. He stayed silent for a moment, then asked, "What are you waiting for?" "Maybe because I don't see the point," I said. "Why should I waste time preparing for a future that might never arrive?" He said I needed to get rid of these pessimistic thoughts. "You should learn Italian because it's the key to our reunification. Nothing else matters more." I didn't respond because I wasn't sure what the honest answer was. Instead, I stared at the blurry pixels of his face. I nodded and said, "Inshallah," even though we both knew it was less a promise and more a way to keep the door from closing completely. Those are excerpts from Trapped Between Two Different Worlds by Ahmad Abushawish, an engineering student, journalist, and activist based in Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, our recent guest, Maha Husseini, a researcher with Euromed Human Rights Monitor, posted this photo on Wednesday of two young people painting a mural on a wall in Gaza City. Here's what Maha writes. Quote, "The University Square is one of Gaza City's most familiar landmarks. It holds the buildings of Gaza's two oldest universities, Al-Azhar University and the Islamic University, places that once pulsed with life. For years, this square was one of the city's busiest roads, shaped by the countless taxis and the daily footsteps of students arriving from every corner of the strip, carrying notebooks and doing last-minute revision for exams as they crossed the street. During the genocide in Gaza, this place was nearly destroyed. Some university buildings were bombed, while others were seized and converted into military bases by Israeli occupation forces. Roads were devastated, infrastructure damaged, and the square that once gathered knowledge was reduced to rubble. I loved this street. I knew it by heart. Here, I earned both my bachelor's and master's degrees. I remember its rain-soaked pavements, how the light reflected on the asphalt, how the city felt alive beneath my feet. This street also housed the media office where I found myself involuntarily becoming a journalist during Israel's 51-day offensive on Gaza in 2014, documenting a war while still learning how to name the world. I witnessed life and death here. I learned, I grew up, and I ran from airstrikes along the same road again and again. As fate would have it, my temporary office during the ongoing genocide now stands on this street. Every morning, I walk past my wounded university. I watch students crossing the devastated roads to reach their lectures, entering the same classrooms where I once studied languages, learning how to speak, how to testify, how to carry our story beyond these walls. Earlier this week, I passed by and saw a young woman and a young man painting a damaged wall of the university. They layered fresh colors over cracks and scorch marks, not to erase what happened, but to refuse its final word. In a place where the occupation tried to silence learning, these young people chose color once again. On a street devastated to crush life, students still arrive every morning. But most of all, I cherish this morning's painting because amid the ruins of a square that once taught me how to speak, life continues to insist on being heard. That's Maha Husseini writing from Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.